Once you've made the decision to take a human life, you're a transformed creature, you're a predator. What does a predator do? They kill. Only a killer can hunt a killer. Are you emotionally, spiritually, psychologically prepared to snuff out a human life in defense of innocent lives? If you can't make that decision, you need to find another job.
That's Dave Grossman, training recruits for one of America's 18,000 police departments. According to The New Yorker, he works 200 days a year. On this podcast, we'll hear how many cops in this country are taught to be warriors based on the fear that they have to kill or be killed, with inherent bias against people of color. What will it take to make them the guardians of all Americans? First, the U.S., Europe, and the pandemic.
We have got the greatest testing program anywhere in the world. We test better than anybody in the world. Our tests are the best in the world, and we have the most of them.
The U.S. is number one in the world in other ways that are nothing for President Trump to brag about. We have more cases of COVID-19 and more deaths from the pandemic than any other country, and that has international consequences. The European Union is prepared to block American travel to 28 countries beginning next week. That's according to Martina Esteves-Grindev, who reports from Brussels for The New York Times. Hi, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
What will this mean for American business?
Well, it won't mean anything good for American or, frankly, European business. For both regions are each other's top trading partners and have massive business and economic links. That means that this disruption that we've had over the last 3 months with COVID taking hold first in Europe and then in America seems set to really cause a much deeper and longer protracted disruption between the exchanges of visits and all that go with them between the two regions.
When Europe was the epicenter in March, President Trump banned travelers from there to the United States. That reportedly infuriated the leaders of Europe. Is this retaliation? Is it political?
It's seemingly not political. The reality is that these measures have been upsetting. They've strained international relations, not just between the United States and the European Union, but really between all sorts of allies around the world. That being said, increasingly, closures of borders became the go-to policy for a lot of countries. Now, there are actually some experts who think they don't work, but they were not heard. As a result, the European Union also suspended all external travel to the EU in around mid-March, really following quite a similar approach to President Trump. And as they prepare to reopen now, it seems that the United States is not going to be on the list of so-called safe countries that will be welcomed into the EU.
What countries are on the safe list?
Well, the safe list is currently a bit fluid. What we reported on was a draft list that should be more finalized early next week and then revisited every couple of weeks. But they are countries that have similar or even better health conditions than the European Union average is right now. So maybe you're thinking something like New Zealand or Iceland. Similarly, on the long draft list that I saw, even China was on there because China actually, because of its massive population size, is showing quite a low incidence rate. It remains to be seen whether additional criteria will be applied by the EU, scientific criteria primarily, to make that list even shorter and even tighter as the bloc begins to reopen to external visitors.
Well, now this puts the United States in a category you report with Russia and Brazil. What does that mean for American prestige?
Look, it's not been a beauty contest throughout this COVID crisis, not just for the US, but also for other developed and wealthy countries like the United Kingdom, for example. Indeed, Sweden, which is a member of the European Union, is not doing very well right now, even though they started off looking much better at the beginning of the crisis. But obviously, the United States occupies a unique position of strength, of gravitas, of importance on the global scene. And to be lumped together because of very bad health outcomes with countries such as Russia and Brazil clearly doesn't reflect very well on the policy decisions that have been made in America.
Well, let's talk some more about the consequences economically. What industries in the United States do you think will be hit the hardest because of this?
I think on both sides of the Atlantic, the most obvious place to look for immediate impact is tourism. Europeans travel to the U.S. Mm-hmm. and Americans travel to Europe throughout the year. And especially that movement is from the U.S. to Europe during those summer months. For example, according to U.S. government data, 7 million Americans traveled to Europe between June and August last year. We're going to see that number be way down in the thousands of essential travelers this year. At the same time, it's impossible to really get our head around the types of interactions that this travel disruption is causing. And with it, obviously, real difficulty with trading and making deals. So we might be seeing interruption of all sorts of economic relations in finance, in investment, manufacturing. These are real lasting problems, and Zoom meetings and conference calls can only compensate just for a fraction of those. There's only so much you can do online.
When you see these lists, and they include some countries and not others, what sort of criteria are used to determine which travelers are acceptable and which aren't?
So that's a great question. And the European Union officials really struggling here to make this list, to put it together before July 1st, when they're supposed to have a new policy in place, have been struggling with that very question. So one thing they have been trying to do is make the criteria for putting together the list as apolitical, non-political, non-dramatic as possible. So they've tried to make it really scientific. One key benchmark they've been using is new cases of coronavirus per 100,000 population. So for the EU, the average is 16. For the US, it's 107. And we may see this as scientific. At the same time, it can be seen as political because, for example, some countries have ultra low rates, but that's not because they don't have the virus. It's because either they're not testing or they're not being truthful about their cases. That then applies a second criterion that the Europeans are looking at, which is, do we trust your methodology and do we trust that you're telling us the truth? That criterion, when applied, will definitely remove some countries from that list that may originally have looked safe. And then there's other things like, is your trajectory upwards or downwards? Namely, have your cases peaked and are now plateauing and dropping? Or are they still peaking? Are things going to continue getting worse for your country? And scientific modelers have ways to approach these things. But what we've seen throughout this crisis is there are no 100% perfect, clear scientific answers. And so even a process as detached, bureaucratic, and scientific as possible, like what the EU is trying to do, is not going to be perfect. And ultimately, it will be seen as being partly political.
Let me ask you, if President Trump is making things better or worse, he has talked very publicly about not doing any more testing in order not to find any more new cases. And there's even some indication today that there might be a relaxation of the emergency called because of COVID-19 in the United States. How does that sound to those who are trying to make these determinations in the European Union?
Well, let me put it this way. If there is a country that the European Union is examining for permitting its nationals to travel to the EU, and it becomes clear that that country is deliberately not testing and therefore potentially underreporting its true cases, that will be a factor that makes it unlikely to label that country safe. I think where the consensus is, and of course we've seen problems with testing across the world, not just in the US potentially, which has been catching up, but also indeed in Europe, everyone agrees the more testing, the better. It gives us a fuller picture of what's really going on, which means we know what the problem is and how to tackle it. Now, certainly, I can tell you from the list, draft list that is under debate right now, there are multiple countries that are likely to be removed and be labeled unsafe because they're not doing enough testing, which means the European Union can't trust whether they're being as, let's say, healthy as they're sounding like they're being, or as their data sort of suggests. So if the US was to go down that route, clearly that would be something that European officials would take into consideration when making their determinations.
What sorts of things do you think American companies are going to try to demand of President Trump in order to reopen access to the European Union? As you said, that's an enormous trading bloc, more important than any other for the United States.
It's not clear to me what U.S. business is demanding of President Trump in terms of reopening to other parts of the world, not just Europe. The message coming out of Washington has been so much about focusing at home, repatriating some supply chains, hunkering down on supporting domestic workers. And that's going to work well for some industries, but there are other industries that are really reliant on America's trade with the world, including Europe. And so I think any form of normalization of relations, exchanges, communication, travel to the rest of the world, including Europe, which is up there for America's business and trading partners, is going to be desirable for several industries in the US. However, others might benefit from this temporary kind of isolation that the coronavirus has brought with it. And so it's just not clear which voices will be louder for the president.
Okay, Martina Stavis-Grednev in Brussels for the New York Times. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, here again, as promised, is Dave Grossman, that trainer for some of America's 18,000 police departments, who tells recruits they have to learn to kill or find another job. He also warns them that they're always subject to public scrutiny.
There is no action you can engage in that will not be on CNN and YouTube tomorrow morning. You don't have to like it. You got to accept it. It's called reality. There's cameras and umpires everywhere.
Now, that kind of warning is timely, since George Floyd's killing by police in Minneapolis. But since then, there have been multiple incidents of chokeholds, violent attacks on peaceful protesters, even killings by police in other parts of the country, recorded on cell phones and surveillance cameras and viewed by millions of people. How come? To find answers, I talked to Seth Stoughton. He's a former policeman himself in Florida, now professor at the University of South Carolina's School of Law, where he's part of the Rule of Law Collaborative and a recognized authority on police behavior.
So there are a bunch of complicated reasons that together are at best partial explanations about why we continue to see policing as an industry make some of the same missteps and mistakes that we've known about. Part of the reason is because policing is so hyper-localized, and our approach to policing and to improving policing tends to also be hyper-localized. So when one particular agency has a scandal, we have historically spent a great deal of time and attention focusing on that agency and figuring out how to improve it. That might be through local policy reforms or the replacement of the police chief or new elected officials or a consent decree after an investigation by the Department of Justice. Unfortunately, that means that any similar problems in the neighboring police agency have gone either unidentified and unaddressed or under-identified and under-addressed. Our approach to policing and police reform has been patchwork in the United States. And it's been politically controversial until, I would say, very recently. Police reform has been cast as something that falls pretty solidly along party lines, where Democrats, progressives, left-leaning individuals see deep problems that need to be addressed, and Republicans, conservatives, right-leaning individuals tend to not. It's only been in the last, I would say easily 5 years that we've started to have a more bipartisan and even nonpartisan understanding that there are some deep flaws with the criminal justice system and some major improvements that could benefit policing in communities around the country.
You began by describing policing as an industry, and you have talked about it, I know, as a culture. Tell us a little bit about the history of it. How did it get to be the way it is now?
Policing as we understand it today, modern policing, is a relatively recent historical development. It really got kicked off in the 1830s and early 1840s in England. It came to the United States at about the same time, just a couple of years later in the 1840s and 1850s. And modern police agencies first supplemented and then supplanted a range of other social, governmental, or semi-governmental, semi-privatized institutions. We had night watch systems in cities and day watch systems in cities. We had constables. We had slave patrols in the American South. We had city militias. All of those eventually gave way to what we now recognize as modern police agencies.
You mentioned slave patrols in the South. I think there were slave patrols in the North as well. Were they not? Does that suggest that bias toward African Americans is somehow baked in to the history of what you describe as an industry?
Bias is pretty deeply baked into society. And as a result, because policing is a social institution, it is very deeply baked into policing. The story in the North and in the South are slightly different, but they are very similar. At the time where modern police agencies really started to evolve in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, the focus in the South on slave patrols and on city militias that existed in large part, although not exclusively, to help prevent slave uprisings, not just to catch runaway slaves, but to help prevent slave uprisings, would go about doing so by terrorizing the black population, both free and enslaved. The North is a little bit different because slavery, although it existed in some northern states, was not as prevalent. But there were similar concerns about migrants, black migrants coming from the South. There was civil unrest that often fell along racial lines. And the early iteration of police agencies were put into the position of dealing with what we would today call social control issues that were that often had racial or ethnic connotations. For example, one of the roles of the local police in the more cosmopolitan cities of the North was to maintain a degree of racial and ethnic segregation so that the Italian or Irish immigrants didn't come into the German part of town, and the German immigrants didn't come into the Irish or Italian parts of town, for example.
Is it fair to say that what was happening with as far as black people were concerned, is it part of the history of policing in the United States that the police have been enforcers of white superiority over black people?
That's a complicated question. The short answer is yes, but there's a lot there. One of the ways of thinking about policing is police are one of the social institutions that we use to control how people behave and control the space in which people behave. I know that's a little bit academic, so let me explain what I mean. When someone is doing something in public, are they doing what we would expect them to do? Are they going to the store, going shopping, going to a parade? Or are they doing what we wouldn't expect them to do? Drinking in public, causing a scene, making a fuss, let alone committing crimes. We have very heavily in this country tended to use the police to deal with social control issues. And we have a long and unfortunate history of racializing issues of social control. That is, for a significant part of our history, it was not socially appropriate, that is, it was not acceptable to the people who had social power to have a black individual walk through their neighborhood. And because police were agents of social control, we turned to the police to ensure that social control. In my hypothetical there, to make sure that the black individual didn't come into the neighborhood. And sometimes they used fairly brutal means to do that. This is not just a historical matter. This isn't something that's just happening in the 1840s and 1850s. We see it very, very clearly in Prohibition, when not only blacks, but certainly blacks were the target of police enforcement on alcohol-related offenses. We see it into the 1930s when blacks and Mexicans particularly were targeted with marijuana enforcement and criminalization. We see it through the 60s and 70s when blacks were targeted as part of civil rights efforts or really anti-civil rights efforts by the part of often all-white police agencies, almost exclusively all-white police agencies. We see it even later into the 1980s and 90s, where we have a tremendous disparity between how we punish possession of crack cocaine as opposed to powder cocaine. And we can see similar disparities today, not just as a policing matter, but as a matter of how we in society use police. So when someone calls the police because a young black graduate student at Yale is sleeping in a common area of their dorm, or because a group of young black men who are businessmen are sitting at a Starbucks because they have not ordered anything yet, we are seeing, although not a perfect parallel, another iteration of how we as society have used police in a very racialized way for social control purposes.
How is this complicated by the militarization of the police, or have they always been militarized?
So policing has not always been militarized, at least not in the way that we understand that today. It surprises a lot of people, including a lot of police officers, to know that originally police officers in this country were not armed. They were not allowed to be armed. In the 1840s and 50s and into the 1860s, most police agencies did not allow officers to carry firearms. Eventually, that began to shift, although how officers carried firearms is still interesting, at least as a historical matter. The police uniforms that were developed were, as you see in very old pictures, they were often Civil War surplus uniforms, and they had sort of long flaps that hung down. I'm sure a historian might be able to give you better terminology than I can, but the short version is they had long flaps that hung down over the weapon that an officer might have in a pouch on their belt. So even when officers were armed, originally they were not visibly armed. At least with a firearm. They would often carry a truncheon or club or something, a baton. We see the sort of modern inclination towards police militarization really in the 1960s as a response to both pretty pervasive social unrest and also some very high-profile instances where police did not have the equipment or training to deal with serious problems. The clock tower shooting, for example, there was a...
Quickly, the clock tower shooting, where was that and under what circumstances?
Let's see. Was that Texas Tech?
I think it was Texas Tech, yeah.
I think it was too. And living in South Carolina and having gone to Florida State, I'm very aware of rivalries, so I don't want to accidentally suggest it was Texas when it was Texas Tech.
Okay. Keep very important distinctions to be made. In any case, there was a guy in the tower on the campus who began shooting people.
That's right. Yeah. And in 1966, a gentleman went to a tower, a clock tower in Austin, and started shooting people. And the police did not have the equipment that they have today. They did not have rifles that they could use to shoot back. So that instance, the Austin Clock Tower incident, and others in the 1960s, gave rise to what started in LAPD as the SWAT movement in policing. And today we think of SWAT as standing for Special Weapons and Tactics. Interestingly, it was originally introduced under the name Special Weapons Attack Team. That was viewed as too militaristic a title, so it was changed to Special Weapons and Tactics. And the idea was that SWAT was supposed to be, they were the officers that normal officers called when the situation was beyond their control. An active shooter, an armed barricaded subject, a hostage situation, heavily armed bank robbers with automatic weapons and body armor. SWAT was supposed to have the weapons, equipment, and training to deal with stuff that line officers simply couldn't. Eventually, the role of SWAT shifted, or at least we had something that academics call mission creep, where that militarized equipment and training and tactics, one, started to be used for things other than those rare but very dangerous situations that I described. For example, we started to see more use of SWAT teams and tactical teams to serve drug warrants, search warrants, or arrest warrants. And two, we saw militarized equipment and tactics start to shift out of SWAT into more generalized aspects of policing. So as a patrol officer in the early 2000s, I had a patrol rifle, for example. I had an AR-15 in my car. There are historical reasons for that. The Columbine shooting is one. The LA bank robbery, where we had some heavily armed bank robbers who had body armor, is another. But that mission creep has continued. And what we see over the last 40 years is a dramatic increase in how many agencies have SWAT teams, how many what the mission parameters are that we use SWAT teams for, and also the training and equipment that was previously reserved to SWAT having shifted into more general policing.
So now we have 18,000 police departments around the country, some very small, requiring no training at all for officers, others much larger in the metropolitan areas, requiring sometimes up to 4 or 5 months of training. But the idea of being a military, it seems to me, is pervasive. And I take it that there is training that takes place, some of it is privately supplied, that encourages that attitude.
I became an officer because I love adrenaline and it's just a fun job to have.
What's the impact, if you will, of those kinds of appeals to people who might want to be police officers? And how does that extend the idea of military policing?
Yeah, so when we're talking about militarized policing, I think most folks who study policing and think about it realize that there is some role for the equipment and tactics that we're talking about. There are situations where officers will need the rifles or the dynamic entry techniques that we might categorize as militarized. The problem is twofold. One is overuse, and the other is the way it affects the police mentality. That is, how does that approach, the militarized equipment or tactics, how does it affect the way that officers view their role in the community and the relationship that they're supposed to have with community members? When we see recruitment videos that present an image of policing as forceful, aggressive, adrenaline pumping with firearms and dogs and helicopters, it one, does not provide an accurate picture of what policing looks like in the United States. But two, the risk is that it will attract candidates who are looking to do something like what they see, as opposed to doing what policing actually is supposed to look like. The more day-to-day aspects of policing, which typically involve talking to a whole lot more people than you're going to use force on or point guns at.
So it sort of perpetuates the military model when, in fact, what police officers are supposed to do is keep the peace, not go to war.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you look at most of the states' statutes that authorize the development of police agencies and the certification of officers or deputies, they generally refer to peace officers, not law enforcement officers, although some states do use that phrase. And that's an important distinction. That's not just semantics. Officers do have law enforcement duties, but they also have a range of duties that are broader than just law enforcement. And in fact, what we know from a number of studies of policing going back at least 30 years, most of what officers do isn't actually law enforcement. The vast majority of officers spend the vast majority of their time doing something other than arresting people or ticketing people or engaged in enforcement activity. So when we have recruitment videos or training in the police academy or provided later by private vendors or the police agency, when we have advertisements in police media like magazines or online that reinforce this idea of officers as soldiers in a hostile war zone, it really undermines, in my view, the social connections and the attitude that officers need to have to succeed in doing the job properly.
We hear all the time, of course, about how they are the thin blue line. The police union head in Minneapolis said that it's not about killing, it's about survival. How important is the idea that an officer is at all times subject to attack, to perhaps even being killed? And what role does fear play in the attitude of these militarized police officers?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the fear-based orientation is, in my view, a serious problem in policing. I don't think we should ignore or underestimate the risks of policing. There are more than, on average, 50,000 officers every year who are assaulted in the line of duty. There are a little more than 50 officers on average killed feloniously every year in the line of duty. That's a risk. That is something that we absolutely have to acknowledge as a society. The problem, though, is that a lot of police training and messaging does not accurately reflect the gravity of the risks. While there certainly are risks, we're also talking about the risks of more than 60 million police interactions every year. So when we look at the number of officers assaulted or injured during an assault or feloniously killed, the percentages are very, very small. But officers can be bombarded with the message that they are at risk, that there is a threat to their very survival, that they have to be hypervigilant at all times. And one of the common phrases in policing is complacency kills. If you get complacent and think that you can relax, even for a few minutes, you are just setting yourself up and maybe your coworkers up to be seriously injured or killed.
Is that why so many police officers are resistant to what we call police reform?
I think that's part of the reason. The idea of a shared sense of threat and survival is a powerful force in policing. It provides a great deal of the motivation behind the solidarity that we see in policing. I don't think it's the only reason, but I think the perception that officers are under threat and the perception that officers have a duty to each other to protect each other from threats has been extended beyond physical threat and extended to criticism. And if you have a culture that values protecting itself from outside criticism, you can see how that might very naturally frustrate mm-hmm. reform efforts. If officers aren't willing to engage with the conversation about doing things better, then it makes it very difficult for us as society to get them to buy into the need for improvement.
So what do you propose then as ways of reforming that would actually cause reform, cause this industry to be more involved with keeping the peace than protecting and being at war with much of society?
So there are a whole range of things that need to happen to get policing where it should be, to get it to live up to its professional ideals. And a number of those changes aren't actually changes that we need to make within policing. A number of those changes are changes that we need to think about making in society more broadly. One of the things I've said, for example, is I don't think we have a race issue in policing. I think we have a race issue in society that is reflected and often magnified in police encounters. I don't think we will ever fix race issues and racist issues in policing without ultimately fixing those problems in society more broadly. But let me give you some specifics. One thing that we can do outside of the context of policing, that is a change that we can make to society rather than to the police industry itself, is how we evaluate the success or failure of police agencies. Right now, when we're looking to figure out whether a police chief did a good job or whether the police agency is doing a good job, we tend to look at crime rates. And policing definitely has a relationship with crime, but it's one that's complicated and multifaceted. And when we reward a police agency or a police chief because crime rates are going down, or when we punish a police agency or fire a police chief because crime rates are going up, we may be rewarding or punishing them based on factors that are largely and sometimes entirely outside of their control. We may also be creating perverse incentives. When a police agency or a police leader is under pressure to reduce crime, they can adopt aggressive zero-tolerance approaches that are effective, or at least that can be effective, in bringing down crime rates in the short term, but can ultimately actually be criminogenic. They can increase crime rates in the midterm or the long term.
Is that also an invitation to be repressive?
Absolutely. It absolutely can be. If officers see their job as crime fighting, and that's the most important aspects of their job, then they're going to view things like civil rights as obstacles to their job rather than the fundamental tenets that help define their job. So that attitude of being the thin blue line that separates society from chaos as part of a higher calling that should know no bounds is problematic and can contribute to repressive and oppressive policing.
How difficult is it to get officers to try to restrain one another in circumstances such as the one we saw with George Floyd in Minneapolis, where one officer was in fact pushing his knee down on the man's neck? And the others weren't doing anything about it. And it turns out they were trainees, and the one who was actually holding them down was with somebody with more experience.
It can be very difficult, particularly because of the cultural norms in policing. In policing, it's very difficult for one officer to criticize another officer. Particularly to do anything that can be considered criticizing another officer in public. And because policing has taken a lot of pride in being a paramilitary organization that has a hierarchical structure, that has a chain of command, it can be very difficult for officers to criticize higher-ranking officers or officers who have simply been officers longer, more experienced officers. So for a recruit, particularly, to criticize a more experienced field training officer is to go against many of the cultural norms in policing. That's not an excuse, but it is something of an explanation, and it helps inform us on what needs to change. It can change. we have programs like the New Orleans Police Department EPIC program, Ethical Policing is Courageous, which I advise everyone to look up, that puts peer intervention at the center of agency culture. It recognizes that one of the most powerful forces in affecting how we behave is what we think our peers expect us to do in any given situation. Social psychologists call this normative conformity, but you don't need fancy academic terms to realize that in most situations, we behave the way our peers and people around us expect us to behave. So what EPIC did is it took peer intervention and made it about helping other officers. Instead of just being protect the public from a rogue cop, which is very difficult for officers to buy into, given the solidarity and what can be a very us versus them mentality, EPIC trains officers in part that when you see another officer who's starting to lose their cool, when you see them starting to go down a bad path, you have an obligation to step in to help save them from making what could be a career-ending mistake. So if you want to protect other officers, you need to be courageous enough to criticize them, to stop them from doing stuff that they shouldn't be doing. And that's been a very successful program that I think can be more widely adopted in other agencies. We know, and the Minneapolis is a good example, we know that just having an intervention policy on the books is not enough. It needs to be trained and it needs to be part of, that is, peer intervention needs to be part of police culture.
Is that a beginning of the effort to make the police seem less like an occupying army than they do now in minority-laden neighborhoods, particularly Black neighborhoods?
I think that's part of it, but I don't think that peer intervention by itself will solve those issues, particularly the simultaneous and somewhat counterintuitive problems of over-policing and under-policing in marginalized neighborhoods, particularly communities of color. And I want to focus for just a second on that idea of over-policing and under-policing, because one of the things that we have heard, particularly in lower socioeconomic class neighborhoods, is they do have problems with crime. And the solution in many cases may not be to pull the police out entirely, but to shift the police focus. Because the same folks who are saying, in many cases, the same folks who are saying, you guys keep making stops, you keep stopping me and looking for drugs, but you're not addressing the burglaries that are happening in the neighborhood or the auto thefts that are happening in the neighborhood. And when you hear a complaint like that, what you're hearing is a complaint about over-policing for some offenses, but also a complaint about under-policing, failing to address other problems in that neighborhood. Now, I do want to be somewhat clear. I'm not suggesting that police can be the cure-all for a whole range of social problems. I think one of the mistakes we've made in society is expecting police or putting police in the position of being the government institution of first response to a range of issues that they can't possibly address. But there are some issues that that we can address more appropriately with a more judicious use of police resources.
Okay, I just want to tell our listeners that we will have links to that EPIC program in New Orleans on our show notes. But I want to ask you this broader question. Again, you talked out at the beginning about how this is an industry, despite the fact that it's divided into 18,000 police departments around the country. How important is it to not just to reform the police themselves, but to get political buy-in and political will and to persuade elected officials that this is something that they have to act on, that it's much more than just depending on the police to supposedly, quote, do their jobs, close quote, and then look the other way?
It is absolutely essential. It is absolutely essential because the history of police reform is one that is marked with political failures. And the failure of elected officials, not just today, but historically, to use their political capital to create not only the social frameworks, but the legal frameworks, the legislation that we need to improve policing as an industry, as opposed to just improving individual police agencies. We have known for a long time that there are issues in policing, going back at least to prohibition in the 1920s.
Blue ribbon commissions have been, since 1929, there have been blue ribbon commissions.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So not every time, but often when we have a policing scandal or what's viewed as a failure, we get these blue ribbon commissions, right? Wickersham in the 20s, Kerner, Knapp in the 60s and 70s, Overtown in the 80s, the Christopher Commission in the 90s, and the Mullen Commission in the 90s, the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing in 2014. And what's amazing and somewhat frustrating to me as a policing scholar and as someone who believes very strongly in the need for good policing is when you stack these blue ribbon commission reports up next to each other, there's almost identical language. You can pull a section out of the Wickersham report that was published in the 1930s, and it is equally applicable to policing last week and next week. We know what the problems are, and we have some pretty sophisticated ideas about how to fix those problems. What we have lacked is political will. Elected officials at the federal level who say, we're going to make some legislative decisions here and we're going to use Congress's power of the purse to incentivize states to adopt particular legislation, and elected officials at the state level who have in many states really dropped the ball on properly regulating police certification, for example, and decertification, or who have allowed police unions to engage in collective bargaining with a much more emphasis on police discipline and procedural protections than I think we would have thought ideal if we had thought about it at the front end.
And also to make contributions to the war chests of various political figures at the state level.
Absolutely. Police unions wield a tremendous amount of political power at the local and state and federal level, but particularly at the local and state level.
You said federal, you said state, and now local with 18,000 police departments. A lot of this has got to be done at the local level, it would seem.
Yes, that's correct. And because policing is so hyper-localized in the United States, the good part about that is it does allow a lot of room for variation and experimentation, a lot of room for agencies to work, hopefully collaboratively with their communities, to figure out what policing should look like in that spot. Because Chicago and Washington, D.C. are different cities. And of course, Washington, D.C. and where I live in Columbia, South Carolina are very different cities. So we don't just want, I think, cookie cutter reforms for policing. There has to be room for local innovation and collaboration. But also, we need to be a little bit cautious about that localization. There are some unfortunate realities where if we allowed complete, well, let me rephrase that slightly. Unfortunately, the reality is if we gave complete local control, if we didn't have any state standards or federal standards, we would find towns and cities across the country that would use police in entirely inappropriate ways to make sure, for example, that Blacks and Mexicans didn't take up residence there. That wouldn't be appropriate, even if it's something that a majority of the local population wanted. But there is a significant role for local intervention by elected officials at the city or county level.
So with people marching all over the country and all over the world right now, and that with police reform being at the center of their demands, are you optimistic? Once again, you said there have been these commissions. We've known for a long time what needs to be done, and we haven't done it. In the meantime, the police are increasingly more militarized and more it would seem to me, set against the rest of the population, seeing themselves as military figures against a whole lot of enemies out there and not very many friends. Are you optimistic at all that reforms of a meaningful nature can be accomplished?
I am, but I'm also cautious. I'm optimistic because we have seen reforms and improvements. And I don't just mean historically, although on the grand scale, that's also true. Policing is in a very different place today and a much improved place than it was in the 1960s and 70s. But I would argue that we've also seen more recent improvements. We have particular agencies like Camden, New Jersey, or Richmond, California, or Tucson, where we have seen police leaders come in and work collaboratively with the communities to build a better police agency. We have police academies like the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Academy that has really professionalized their approach to police training and has tried to instill in young officers at maybe the most important time in their careers, the value of being community guardians, of being peace officers and not just law enforcers. I think there is room for optimism. I think there's room for optimism because there are so many people who are turning their attention to the need for police reform. The fact that we have marches across the country is simultaneously a signal that we have failed as a society to make the changes that we need to make, but it's also a signal that there is broad public support for and demand for improvement. And that is the kind of things that elected officials respond to.
So how important is it when the president says something like this to a crowd of police officers?
I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody. Don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
It is not only manifestly inappropriate, it is also incredibly counterproductive when you have an elected official, in a very real sense, the most important elected official in the country, who has willfully abandoned any interest in maintaining a sense of moral decency and made statements that are, or at least certainly should be, seen as anathema within policing. The obligation to serve and protect, the obligation to protect community members from unnecessary indignities and harms, including the community members that officers may be arresting or even using force on, is so fundamental that the idea, the assertion that officers should be less careful, the assertion that they should allow, if not promote, a subject to injure themselves as they get into a police car, for example, is something that should offend every professional police officer in the country. The fact that it doesn't is a pretty damning indictment of a certain perspective about policing.
Is one of the problems that police officers tend to be supportive of President Trump?
I'm not going to criticize any individual officer's support for any political candidate. What I will criticize, and what I think is appropriate, is any officer's support for some of the ideas that seem to indicate a particular approach to policing that President Trump has used in some of his rhetoric. It is often entirely inappropriate to the context of domestic policing. It is often racialized in very problematic ways. And it should, or at least a great deal of his rhetoric and his assertions about policing should be viewed as the bombastic but ignorant statements of someone who simply does not understand the operational realities of policing. I would worry very deeply about any officer who agreed with the president that officers should be less gentle and less protective with secured subjects, for example.
So I would think then the bottom line is that you would think real reform, which certainly gets down to getting officers on the street to do things differently than they have been doing them, at least to some extent now, will require major political change all the way up the line in the United States.
I do. I don't think we can have police reform without shifting the social and legal backdrop against which police operate. And that is going to require changes by not just police officers and not just police chiefs, but also by elected officials at the federal, state, and local level. It's going to require rethinking the role that we, society, put police in, what we expect them to do. As, for example, the way that we have tended to make homelessness and other aspects of poverty, substance abuse and alcoholism and mental health and, in many cases, school discipline, we have turned those into policing issues when we shouldn't have. Fixing that is not something that a police agency is going to be able to do. Even with all of the interest in support for reform, that type of solution needs to come from outside policing, and it needs to come from elected officials.
Seth Stouten, you have a lot of experience in this area, and it's been very, very interesting and educational, I think, to talk with you, and I hope our listeners feel the same way. I certainly do. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it, even if I regret the necessity.
In a moment is Chief Justice John Roberts taking aim at Attorney General William Barr on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're on Omni back with To the Point. June is a month for momentous decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court, much awaited by President Trump and his conservative base, much dreaded by liberals who fear the 5-4 majority, when it includes Chief Justice John Roberts. But Roberts may now be focused on Attorney General Bill Barr, who's being called Trump's all-out vengeance machine. That's from Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the court for Slate and joins us now. Hi, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
You've also called the Attorney General an authoritarian bagman. Sounds like you have lost patience with him. Do you think John Roberts has too?
Well, I can't speak for John Roberts. I can say, and part of the impetus for writing the piece was, we've now seen Bill Barr consolidate power in really, I think, profoundly alarming new ways, most notably last weekend, when we saw the removal of the U.S. Attorney, Jeffrey Berman, for the Southern District of New York. It's clear Barr wasn't truthful about that removal. He said that Berman had quit. Berman came out right out shooting, saying, "I didn't quit." Then he was removed. And it seems that Barr wanted to do in the Southern District of New York what he's already done in D.C. when he removed Jesse Liu. She was the U.S. attorney there. And I think that the outcry has been really profound, Warren. I think that the idea that lifelong career attorneys are being removed summarily and then replaced often with people who have no expertise doing this kind of courtroom and prosecutorial work. And so really for me, the question was, given that there is an outcry, it seems to be bipartisan, Washington is reeling with this, as is the Justice Department, might it be the case that John Roberts, who is an institutionalist, who cares about the rule of law, might be reacting. It might be starting to inflect on the ways that he's ruling.
You've written about how the so many lawyers in the Department of Justice have actually quit, and hundreds of former Department of Justice lawyers have said they want Barr's resignation. But he kind of blew it with the New York thing, because now the acting U.S. attorney is going to be a real professional who's been there for quite a while. So he didn't get what he wanted.
He didn't get what he wanted. He was trying to initially replace Jeffrey Berman with Craig Carpenito. He's the U.S. attorney for New Jersey. And he's trying ultimately to put in this guy, Jay Clayton. He's chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, but he has to go through the confirmation process. And you're quite right. All of that got waylaid because of the way he fired Berman, and Berman kicked up enough of a ruckus that it is now the case that Berman's deputy, Audrey Strauss, becomes the acting U.S. attorney. And so I think it did backfire for him, but it just appears to be of a piece with this larger pattern that we've seen, you know, with the Roger Stone sentencing, and then with the complete reversal in the Michael Flynn case, where more and more and more we see Bill Barr using the entire machinery of the Justice Department with criminal and civil powers that just boggle the mind to punish Trump's adversaries and to try to reward Trump's cronies. And it's really significant that Berman seems to have been in the middle of investigating not just Rudy Giuliani, but several of his confederates. And Trump has said overtly, this comes out in the new John Bolton book, that the people in the Southern District of New York are, quote, like not his people, and he's trying to remove them. So I think this act of kind of doing the president's bidding and using DOJ to effectuate that really has drawn, as you said, just horror across the political spectrum from people who think, particularly post-Watergate, Warren, that DOJ just can't be used as the president's errand boy.
Let's get back to the U.S. Supreme Court. Already, having turned in a couple of decisions that President Trump didn't like at all, one prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people, written by Neil Gorsuch, his first appointee. Then we had Chief Justice Roberts writing the decision on DACA. That was something that the president didn't want to see. It was regarded as a rebuke of his. What decisions are upcoming that will give the Chief Justice, if he chooses to do so, an opportunity to sort of hold Barr and Trump to account?
Well, I think that the big one, and the one that in some sense is the litmus test for Barr, is going to be those financial oversight cases. So that's Trump versus Mavesars, Trump versus Deutsche Bank. Those are congressional subpoenas. And we also have the New York subpoena, the grand jury subpoena, to try to get hands on this tranche of financial documents as part of investigations.
Those are President Trump's financial documents.
Exactly. Trying to get lay hands on Trump's financial documents. And it's worth saying in both of those cases, it was a really quite an extraordinary posture that the Justice Department adopted in trying to defend Trump's documents. They actually had a lawyer say at the Second Circuit in one of these appellate arguments that Trump could shoot somebody literally on Fifth Avenue and not be subject to criminal penalties. And so they've staked out a position that is way beyond what the court would have allowed after the Watergate cases and the Clinton cases, Paula Jones. And so I think, again, that's probably the best evidence of Barr weaponizing the Justice Department just to protect the president. And this is documents that predate his presidency. These are documents that any other president would have turned over. And so the idea that the DOJ has gotten way beyond what the doctrine allows and tried to make these very absolutist claims about immunity from scrutiny will be the litmus test for whether John Roberts is willing to sign off on anything Trump wants and anything Barr asks for.
a litmus test for the supporters of President Trump and perhaps for the president himself is anything that has to do with Roe versus Wade. There is a decision waiting around on that issue. Do you think it's possible that that might go against what the president wants? Because if it does go the other way, it would practically make abortion impossible in the state of Louisiana.
This is such a big deal, and I think it's the case that a lot of people are holding out hope that John Roberts will yet again throw in with the liberals. I think you're right to flag that the wins, the huge wins last week, have led some progressives to say, wow, the shoe's about to drop. We're going to get shellacked the rest of the term. And others to say, maybe this is a new, different John Roberts. And the truth is, it's anybody's guess right now, but I think it will be very, very important to see what the Chief Justice does in June Medical, because it's not just that it's a case about abortion that implicates the future of Roe v. Wade. It's also, most pointedly, a case that on identical facts, just out of Texas and not Louisiana, the court decided in 2016. And if John Roberts cares about precedent and stare decisis, he's going to care a lot about the appearance of the court simply flipping in 4 short years because the composition of the court changed. And so we're not just watching that as a marker of do we have a different John Roberts, but as a marker of how serious the Chief Justice is when he says that precedent really matters.
Okay, we remember every year about this time how extraordinarily important the U.S. Supreme Court can be politically as well as legally. It's always great to talk with you.
It's always great to be with you.
Dahlia Lithwick with Slate and also her podcast, Amicus. Good luck with that, and thanks again for being with us.
Thank you so much.
The producer of To The Point is Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prebatary. Other episodes are available on your favorite podcasting app. And if you want to reach us, we're at tothepoint_KCRW. If you want to reach me directly, I'm at WarrenAlney1. If you want to learn more about our guests and what we've talked about on our show, please visit our webpage. Go to kcrw.com/shows and scroll down to The Point. We'll have links and details about our guests for all of our segments in all of our show notes. And finally, before we go, here's a little advice from our governor, Gavin Newsom. There is no excuse, he says, for not wearing a mask. Protect others by wearing a face covering. Please, just be thoughtful. That's good advice. So thanks for being with us this time, and join us again.